This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what will be the fate of the so-called Dreamers, and what are the contours of longer-term immigration reform in the United States? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The fate of young people brought to this country illegally has triggered a larger debate over immigration reform. The roughly 1.8 million children, often referred to as Dreamers, have heretofore been protected from deportation under an Obama-era initiative called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA. But U.S. President Donald Trump rescinded that program in September 2017, giving Congress 6 months to come up with a legislative remedy. The White House recently issued a broader framework on immigration reform and border security, which President Trump highlighted in his State of the Union address last week.
It's time to reform. These outdated immigration rules, and finally bring our immigration system into the 21st century. These four pillars represent a down-the-middle compromise and one that will create a safe, modern, and lawful immigration system.
Mr. Trump pointed out that he supports a path to citizenship for the 1.8 million Dreamers as part of a package that also includes funding for a border wall along the U.S. border with Mexico and other deep changes to the U.S. immigration system. The White House proposal would restrict family-based immigration, the underpinnings of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, the channel by which most immigrants have come to the United States for the past half century. It also calls for an end to a diversity lottery program that randomly awards 50,000 green cards annually to foreigners from countries underrepresented in U.S. immigration. Many political analysts say that the immigration issue should be addressed in two stages. Phase one would be focused on regularizing the status of the DACA recipients while appropriating funds needed to secure the border. Phase two would include a wider range of issues, such as possibly ending the diversity lottery program, enhancing enforcement in the workplace, and reorienting policy away from family reunification and toward a merit-based metric of individual contribution. Well, with us to discuss the fate of DACA recipients and prospects for long-term immigration reform are two distinguished political analysts. Andrew Seeley is president of the Migration Policy Institute, and that's a Washington-based nonpartisan nonprofit think tank dedicated to analysis of the movement of people worldwide. Previously, Andrew Seeley served as executive vice president at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Michael Barone, he's a political analyst and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. Michael Barone is also a journalist and senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, a newspaper here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Andrew Seeley of the Migration Policy Institute, let me begin with you to get your take on how to address this issue of immigration reform. Would you agree, as some analysts say, that perhaps we should just look at the DACA fix first and then perhaps go to the larger issue? And would that be politically acceptable, in your view, with respect to the White House and Congress?
Both sides have tried to make this bigger than about DACA over time, and my sense is Congress doesn't have the appetite for a giant reform right now, certainly not before the DACA deadline. So you probably do have to have a smaller fix if this is going to get fixed, DACA in exchange for some sort of enforcement. But a lot of issues have been put on the table by President Trump to begin with, but also by people in both parties in Congress about how we reform our system generally, about how we shift maybe a little bit from family immigration into skills-based immigration. What do we begin to do long-term about the unauthorized population? What do we do long-term about enforcement? And those are bigger issues that at some point our country needs to deal with. And we need a legal immigration system that makes sense for the century that we're in right now. We have a system that's quite old, and we'll see if we can get to those issues. Hopefully we can.
Turning to you, Michael Barone, you understand how difficult this immigration reform is It has bedeviled administration after administration, but we're now at another inflection point. How do you see going forward?
I think I see it a little differently. I think that President Trump has forced this issue by announcing that he was going to withdraw the DACA executive order, and he made the point, which I think is an accurate one, that there's some serious question about whether the DACA executive order is legal and would be upheld if and when it comes to the courts, and so that having legislation would give the DACA recipient something much more certain than an executive order which might be ruled to be illegal and beyond the scope of the existing law passed by Congress. But I think in return, he's going to insist on something, in that most of the Republicans, whose party is in a majority in the Congress, are going to insist on some things that they want to have done now. And I think that will include getting rid of the visa lottery program, which doesn't have very many defenders at this point. And I think it may involve as well something that Andrew Seeley mentioned, which is moving towards away from extended family unification, beyond the nuclear family of parents and children, which accounts for the majority of our legal immigrants today, and moving towards a skill-based system more like what people have in Canada and in Australia. And I think that the Republicans are going to resist a two-stage process where they get relief for the DACA people now and, in their view, promises of something else later, which may never be fulfilled. I think that in this situation, the president and the Republican Party has leverage by saying, look, you want DACA relief, we want DACA relief, but we want some other things too. Democrats aren't going to like that. As Winston Churchill once said, he'd written a nasty article about somebody. He said he did not like it. He was not meant to like it. But it's something that they may very well insist on before they get it. And right now, many members of the Democratic Party, as we saw in their personal reactions at the State of the Union address, very kind of sullen, unhappy, watching President Trump, whom they don't like, don't trust, and who they think is wrong on serious issues. They and the core constituency, millions of Democratic voters out there in America, don't really want to see concessions to Mr. Trump.
Well, back to you, Andrew Seeley. This topic is obviously fraught with politics, but what about public opinion? Let's just look at the Dreamers right now, these children brought over illegally by their parents, for whom something has to be done to regularize their status. Otherwise, they will have to leave and go back to countries that they have not known at all. They're much more American. But public opinion, where does it stand on the Dreamers, and to what extent will that be a factor taken into consideration by members of Congress?
Immigration public opinion is always complex, except on the Dreamers, where it's been pretty unanimous that, not unanimous, but in the 70 to 80% range, and majorities in both parties of people who are sympathetic to doing something to legalize the Dreamers. Now, whether it's a pathway to citizenship or allowing them to stay without full citizenship, but there's an enormous sympathy with doing something that keeps them in this country. On the other side, though, there's a lot of pressure on Democrats to do something. That's the pressure on President Trump, who has expressed sympathy himself for the Dreamer population, not to want to be in the situation where he ends up with a deal that falls through entirely and you do see the first deportations. In reality, people wouldn't automatically be deported. They would simply be subject to deportation down the road if they were caught. But you would see people who get caught up early on, and I think those are photos that the White House doesn't want. And the White House is openly sympathetic to the idea of doing something with this population. So we may see a permanent solution. I think there's a play out also in which there is not a permanent solution. Right now, everything falls through, and there's a midpoint where Congress reaches an agreement on something, on another temporary fix, but with a legislative backing. So it's not going back to executive order. You have something where Congress, you know, extends what existed by executive order for 2 or 3 years, but it has to be renegotiated again.
Back to you, Michael Barone. I know you just said that you don't think that the Congress will look at this in two stages, but to what extent is public opinion a factor, and could that influence members of Congress?
Well, you know, when you say two stages, I'm going to give you some cake right now so you get your cake, and you're promising to give me some fruit 2 weeks from now. I may never get the fruit. Public opinion, Andrew, is correct. You basically see Americans responding in line with a basic Judeo-Christian belief that the sins of the father should not be visited on the son. There's societies in the world which take the view that you're responsible for everything that members of your family does. Americans believe in individual responsibility, and it comes from Jewish and Christian heritages, so it's pretty strongly held belief in this country. There is a danger, of course, that the DACA executive order goes out of existence and you have some deportations. There are also a couple of other contingencies operating here. One of them is that there's now a court case challenging DACA in a U.S. district court in San Francisco, I think. I think that's a very weak case, but right now it's on appeal. It has not yet been reversed. I think it will be, but these things don't always happen instantly. The Supreme Court is taking a look at it, so that may provide additional delay. And President Trump also has the option of extending an executive order for some long or short period to try and move Congress along if they don't make the March 8th deadline when he said that he will allow the executive order will elapse. He can say, okay, well, let's get it done by March 10th. Or March 18th. In business and political negotiations, negotiators will extend a deadline in a short period of time if they're negotiating, and that can be an impetus to reaching agreement.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Andrew Seely, he's president of the Migration Policy Institute, and Michael Barone, from whom you just heard, he's a political analyst and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We're discussing the fate of children, also known as dreamers, of undocumented immigrants and the debate over U.S. immigration reform. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Babajide Ogunsanya. He's a loyal listener from Lafia, Nasarawa State in north central Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Andrew Seely, and let's take a look at some of the measures that the Trump administration has put forward to reform the immigration system. The Trump administration talks about ending this visa lottery system, talking about the end of chain migration. Is that just another name for ending this family reunification basis?
Yeah, family reunification has been the technical term that's been used for years, but chain migration has been used to say that there's a lot of people coming in beyond the immediate family, particularly by people opposed to it. You know, as Michael pointed out, we're unusual in the industrialized world in having most people come in through family visas in the legal system. Most other industrialized countries, Canada, Australia, and many European countries, the majority of people come in through some skills category. Not always high-skilled, sometimes low-skilled and medium-skilled, but something having to do with their employment rather than their family connections. The U.S. is very much an outlier and it mostly being family. And so one of the questions that's on the table is, you know, do we move towards a more skill-based system? Do we move towards something that has more to do with employment? We probably don't want to get rid of the family immigration system. The nuclear family has been important. Some people would argue that siblings matter to a degree. It's been very important in integration, people coming to the United States and being able to set down roots very quickly because they have other family members. President Trump has put this on the table. It's been on the table before in attempts to reform the immigration system. If you took his four pillars and you maybe combined them into three, you could actually have a serious conversation among all sides. They might disagree on the details, but eventually we're going to have to figure out what our legal immigration system looks like. We're going to have to figure out what enforcement looks like. And we're going to have to figure out what happens to the unauthorized population, people who don't have documents, both the dreamers and other people living in this country, and do some of them come out of the shadows. You know, those three things really frame the debate going forward as they have in the past.
Quickly, before I turn to Michael, if the United States did curtail this family reunification basis of coming to the United States legally, would that upend the 1965 Immigration Reform Act pretty much, or just simply modify it?
It would modify it. And actually, I think the reason why you might get a two-stage is I think there is a sense in which it's not just enough to modify what we have. We actually need to rethink what we have. And President Trump put the idea of skills-based on the table again, as have some Democrats and Republicans, but it wasn't part of his State of the Union address. And at some point, the question is, how do you cut back on some of the family? But you have to add in some employment-based visas, and that has not been on the table yet. So I think that's a bigger conversation.
One of the things that is true here is that it was not anticipated that extended family unification beyond parents and children, would be the cause of most entrants to the United States. When the 1965 bill was passed, that provision was added because the congressmen from some East Coast cities thought they wanted to have their relatives from Italy or Greece. Well, we haven't had much immigration from Italy or Greece the last few years. We've had a lot of immigration from other parts of the world, and it has tended to be lower skill than immigration that you get from point systems in Canada or in Australia, two nations that have much in common demographically with the United States. And President Trump said when he announced his candidacy in 2015 that Mexico is not sending their best. That's actually a factual statement in terms of immigrant flow from Mexico on our southern border has been lower skill on average. The Pew Research Center, other institutions whose data is generally highly trusted by people on all sides of the issue, attest to this. Interestingly, we are getting high-skill immigrants from some places you wouldn't know, perhaps. Immigration from Ghana and Nigeria, immigrants from those countries tend to be people with high levels of education. And by the way, unlike what some of President Trump say, they're not white.
Indeed. Well, that just leads me to have to mention in this context a bad word I can't really say on the air that Mr. Trump allegedly said with respect to some of these countries. And that is unfortunate because people know the United States as a nation of immigrants. And some of our most highly skilled and talented immigrants have come from countries that Mr. Trump inadvertently was referring to. And we're talking about developing countries, whether in Africa or elsewhere. So this is a problem of perception that probably we need to address, Andrew Seely, and we need to correct the record in that regard. But back to the whole question of reforming immigration, the visa lottery, would that be something that both Democrats and Republicans and others could agree to perhaps end or phase out? How useful is it to date, or do you think it has outlived its usefulness?
It was put in there largely because there were some members of Congress concerned about European immigration, countries that weren't having a lot of people go to Ireland, particularly. Exactly. That was the impetus. It doesn't have much of a constituency, except increasingly because it's the conduit for people from Africa. There is some pushback actually from the Congressional Black Caucus saying, wait a minute, this would disproportionately affect Africans. But one of the things that's interesting is both the family system and the diversity system have actually brought highly educated people to this country. And one of the things we found out recently is of recent immigrants, about half actually have college degrees. And that compares to about a third of Americans have college degrees, native-born Americans. In the last 5 years, that's 2011 to 2015, 48% of the people that came to this country through our immigration system overall had college degrees. And it's particularly high, actually, both in diversity and in family immigration. Even Mexicans, because the unauthorized flow has slowed down so much, about a fifth of the Mexicans actually have college degrees.
One of the things that's true here is that immigration from Mexico dropped off a cliff, fell dramatically after the 2007-2008 recession. We were getting 40% of our immigrants in the whole world were coming from Mexico. Now it's a much smaller figure. We're getting more people from India than Mexico. We're getting more people from China than Mexico. And as Andrew and I have pointed out, we've got these high-skilled people from places like Nigeria and Ghana, where we're drawing people from countries that are developing in those cases. You have some countries that have had very low level of development like Haiti, but we get rather high-skill immigrants from them. Some people say we shouldn't take them because it's a brain drain on these countries.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's an argument that you can make really from the point of view of the other points. My own view is that America, we can never attract enough Einsteins. It's a good idea to encourage and that we should be moving towards a high-skill thing. We've got this as a result of an accident in the legislation in 52, 53 years ago that nobody anticipated, and we get an immigrant flow of tens of millions of people, which is not what anybody wanted initially, what anybody really voted for or intended to vote for. We should change that.
Assuming we can reach a compromise on phasing out or redesigning this diversity visa lottery program, Andrew, and coming to some compromise with respect to family reunification, but also merit-based visas, or rather immigration. What about the so-called border wall, which was a very important plank in President Trump's campaign? And of course, his so-called base does not represent the majority of Americans, but nonetheless, his call for border security does resonate with many Americans. To what extent do you think a compromise can be reached on that much more controversial issue?
Yeah, a wall itself is probably the most expensive and least effective way to control the border. And it's not very popular among Americans. But when you start talking about border security overall and enforcing the legal system, then people are more interested, right? And I think there is a compromise that can be made. And we've heard the White House beginning to message this differently in recent weeks of, yes, doing a border wall, which is important for Trump politically. I mean, he wants to show that he built a physical barrier on part of the border, but also increasing technology and agents and others. It may not be the most important part of enforcing immigration laws. I mean, the reality is about half or slightly more than half of people that come and stay without authorization in the country are coming with visas these days. They're not coming across, but there is still a significant number of people coming across the border, mostly from Central America these days, fewer from Mexico. But probably you want a balance of looking at interior enforcement, looking at visa overstays, as well as border security. But let's face it, for Donald Trump, this is a promise he made to the core constituency that stood with him during the primaries, that stood with him during the general election, and I don't think he's going to let go of it.
Although we should keep in mind that even during the campaign, he retreated from his initial statement that he wanted a border on all the 2,000 miles of border between U.S. and Mexico to saying border or other measures, because half of that barrier is along a river, the territory on the U.S., and I think on the Mexican side is in many cases privately owned.
I think what Andrew said is important because sometimes we project or telegraph misinformation. For example, the fact that a wall would not be as effective or cost-effective in preventing illegal immigration because most people overstay visas. And that's the kind of information that
Well, we've clearly can move forward in keeping track of visas. We've got this thing called the internet now, that and electronic communications, and we don't have to let a little cardboard card. But I think clearly there can be some movement there. You know, I don't think a nation has to apologize for having a wall on its border. I think that nations are entitled to do that. Israel has one that is very effective indeed. The idea that walls can't be effective is not really accurate. And we have a border on some parts of the border in heavily populated parts of southern coastal California, in southern Arizona. Part of our border there is an Indian reservation. I think the Democrats are going to end up conceding this, even though some of them like to say, well, the border is trivial and it never works and it doesn't matter.
But as you said, it seems like they will come around. We have something called the Problem Solvers Caucus, Andrew Seeley, and that's 24 Democrats, 24 Republicans in Congress who are trying to work toward a bipartisan solution. And they've come up with a framework. So back to this whole idea of trying to regularize the Dreamers in the short term and somehow in the medium and long term coming up with a more comprehensive immigration reform package. What do you think the prospects are as the clock ticks down now?
I think there's a chance you can get to a compromise that includes border spending, that includes considerable part of the wall. There's a wall about a third of the border, actually, about 600 miles worth in the U.S.-Mexico border. So, you know, you get more miles, you get some reinforcements, you'll get other kinds of technological barriers, additional border patrol agents. I think you can look at some interior enforcement within that, probably. Legalizing a broad population of the Dreamers or a narrow population, that's a big debate. There's about 600,000 to 700,000 people who are covered by DACA. They might include slightly more of young people that came to this country illegally as young people or not. And I think the diversity visas days are numbered. I think that's one that will be probably the easiest to sacrifice. I'm not sure what will happen on the sibling visas. And not because people don't agree with getting rid of it, but I think you're going to see Democrats pushing back because they want to see that as part of a larger negotiation on immigration reform and also legalizing other parts of the unauthorized population. But it could happen.
And you get the last word, Michael Barone, on the, is there the political will, the politics to really get something done short and long term?
I'm not sure. I'm actually a little pessimistic. I can see things that I think the different parties and factions should agree to based on what their ideas and principles are as best I can gather them. I'm not at all sure they want to do it. I think President Trump has gone some distance. I think there's a lot of people in the Democratic Party that would rather have an issue than a law. That's because they hope they can win majority in the House of Representatives, perhaps even a majority in the Senate, though that's very difficult with the array of seats that are up this November. There are a lot of Democrats that just basically are shrieking with pain that Donald Trump is president of the United States, and they think they can get rid of him in a short period of time. I think they're deluded about that, but that's a force that's going to be hard to overcome in this negotiation.
Well, Michael Barone, you make a very good point, because we must always consider the politics, and that's a very important point. I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrew Seely, he's president of the Migration Policy Institute, and Michael Barone, political analyst and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you. Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.